The open mind, free to examine, to question, to disagree. Our subject today, can fallout shelters save us? Your host on The Open Mind is Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University and author of Rendezvous with Destiny and the Crucial Decade.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Before beginning the regular program, I would like to speak a personal word. For some 3 years now, the producer of The Open Mind has been Mrs. Eleanor S. Rigger. With this program, she discontinues her connection with us to take on other responsibilities. I would like to say that a good deal, a very great deal, of whatever we have been able to contribute on this program is attributable to Eleanor Rigger's hard work, to a quite unusual imagination and knowledgeability, and to her dogged devotion to the highest standards of public affairs programming. All of us associated with The Open Mind are losing a gifted colleague, and we are losing to our weekly contact with a charming and high-spirited friend. We will miss you, Eleanor, and good luck in your other endeavors. And now, gentlemen, to our program itself. Several months ago, the President of the United States summoned our nation to a new duty, fallout protection, he said, for every American as soon as possible. He stressed the federal government was going to move. He called on the local governments to move. And he emphasized the importance of individual shelters. This speech, amid the darkening skies of international relations, of course, has produced a great deal of talk and a great deal of action about shelters against fallout. And as the talk and action has gone on, it's become clear that we're dealing with a very complex subject, one that has at least three parts. One, what are we talking about in terms of practical protection? Two, what are the political implications of shelters? Political in the large and important sense. And three, what are the moral and psychological implications? Our panel today, here to my right, Mr. Oscar M. Riebhausen, attorney and chairman of Governor Rockefeller's Special Task Force on Protection from Fallout. Next to him, Congressman William Fitz Ryan, representative from the 20th District, New York City, who has recently introduced a resolution to set up a joint congressional committee to investigate the ramifications of civil defense. Mr. David F. Cavers, Fessenden Professor of Law at Harvard University. Mr. Norman Cousins, editor of the Saturday Review, and Mr. William Higginbotham, past president of the Federation of American Scientists and head of the Instrumentation Division of the Brookhaven Laboratories. Mr. Riebhausen, may I ask you to start us with a comment on a quotation which I think represents a point of view somewhat different from yours. When Governor Rockefeller was first beginning his campaign for shelters, he was questioned by Governor Robert Miner of New Jersey in some very vigorous words. Miner said that a civil defense program of shelters was what he called a cruel deception on the American people. He asked, what happens when the people come out of these shelters, to quote him directly, what kind of a world would they come up to? What would they use for air, for food, for hospitals? What would they use for streets? And he concluded with the grim question, what would they use for people?
Mr. Goldman, that's an extreme statement. I am familiar with it and with Governor Miner's point of view. In my own opinion, the cruelest deception on the American people would be to deprive them of the opportunity to protect themselves when we know how to survive the fallout from a nuclear attack. This is a subject in which there have been many misconceptions and a great deal of emotion which has clouded rational thinking. But I think there are a couple of things we should have clearly in mind. The air is not poisoned by a nuclear attack, no matter how intense. We can survive. The air can be breathed if we have shelter. Another thing we should have clearly in mind is the distinction between blast from a nuclear explosion and the fallout, which occurs also from a nuclear explosion. Both of these are measurable in their effect, but the fallout is the more extensive. And according to the studies conducted by the National Administration, the fallout will cause more casualties than can be caused by blast. so that the fallout, which may extend as many as 200 or so miles downwind from an explosion, is the thing which we must and can protect against. May I add just quickly two things. The way to protect against fallout is clear, because a density of mass, a density of thickness between you and the radiation outside will protect you. And secondly, we have going for us a phenomenon which is that the radiation declines at a very rapid rate. So time is on your side.
Mr. Higginbotham, as our only scientist here, are you as clear about all these things as Mr. Riebhausen is?
Well, I think that certainly one should make some qualifications. It's very rather glib to say that we can survive. I think that perhaps I'd like to comment on the question and see if perhaps we shouldn't broaden it a little bit. We're talking about fallout shelters. What we're interested in is security in case a war occurs. And I think that if one is talking about survival of a large or an appreciable fraction of the population of the United States, more is involved in fallout shelters. There's a problem of preparation of the shelters themselves, food and water and supplies for the shelters if we build them, and there's a problem of recovery, which is likely to be extremely difficult. I think that I certainly disagree with people who feel it's a totally hopeless problem, and I do feel very much it should be discussed. But I certainly think we shouldn't make any statement which sounds in the least bit optimistic about the degree of survival.
Mr. Cousins?
It seems to me, Mr. Goldman, that one of the reasons for the confusion in this question is that people tend to be discussing different things. For example, I think that Mr. Riebhausen was probably discussing a limited nuclear war, whereas Governor Minor was considering a generalized, massive nuclear war. Now, it makes a great deal of difference whether an enemy drops, let us say, 7,000 megatons of nuclear energy or fission on a country in the first few waves of an attack, or whether he just seeks out, let us say, the industrial targets and the specific military targets. If the enemy is just interested in knocking out military targets, he may use a limited amount of nuclear explosives to accomplish that purpose. And I believe that under these circumstances, there would be perhaps a high degree of protection and shelters. But I think it a cruel deception on the American people not to point out that when people talk about safety, they're talking about a limited nuclear attack. And in an all-out nuclear attack, the factor of safety is an extremely small one. Now, as Mr. Riebhausen has said, you've got several factors involved in a nuclear attack. You've got the blast, the concussion effects, you've got the fire effects, you've got the radiation effects. And these three things operate differently depending on where you are. For example, in the city, you probably would have to contend more with the problem of blast than the people in the country. But in the city, you have to contend with all three, blast, fire, and radiation. In the outlying areas, which is to say up to 50 miles from a city, the problem of blast is not critical. But you do have a problem of fire, especially firestorms overhead, and the problem of radiation. Now, it is true that most of the radiation has short life characteristics, but it is equally true that several radioactive materials, strontium-90, cesium-137, carbon-14, live for a long time and exercise their punitive effects over a long period.
Well, Mr. Riebhausen, do you accept all these qualifications?
I don't accept the premise that I was basing my comment only on a limited war. I accept what Mr. Higginbotham said, that this is more than a single problem. But in analysis of it, it is much easier to take one problem at a time. And the fallout shelter problem is one problem. The fallout from even an all-out nuclear attack...
What is an all-out nuclear attack, Mr. Riebhausen?
Everything that could be delivered by any potential enemy today on our country. The fallout that would result from that, we can protect against. And our people can survive.
I think you should say to what extent...
Pardon?
I think you should say to what extent you can protect against it.
The fallout you can protect 100% against.
That's the most remarkable statement I've ever heard in my life.
Now, I think that is quite inconsistent with the scientific reports that have come to my attention
I haven't heard anyone say that, Mr.
For instance, I think it's reasonable.
Pardon me, just a moment. Mr. Higginbotham, you wince at that. You deny this scientifically, is that correct?
Well, certainly nobody can make such a sweeping statement as that, that you can have complete and 100% protection.
Not for $150.
The intensity of in any kind of a war, whether it's a rather limited one or a very large one, I think the intensity of the fallout will vary by tremendous factors over different parts of the country.
Right.
And there'll certainly be places where people were in shelters, they might be pinned down for 6 months, and I think that would be the finish. There are other places where they might be pinned down for only a couple of days, in which case the shelter would be very beneficial. But I would prefer to see the argument on the discussion of how much is it worth to us, do we feel it's valuable to discuss something which has a limited possibility, but still is a type of insurance, in the same way that one takes out medical insurance, not with the belief that it's going to cure cancer, if cancer, in many cases, is incurable, but you may have other diseases.
Well, Mr. Ryan, were you questioning that same point?
I was questioning the same point, Mr. Goldman. It seems to me that Governor Minor does have a point in his statement. It seems to me that the American people have not been brought face to face with the facts as the scientists understand them, which will come about in a nuclear war. I think that if we assume there is going to be a nuclear attack that reaches a very high level, and I understand that it's reasonable to assume we may have now the capacity, or Russia may have the capacity, or some other country, to deliver a 5,000 megaton attack upon the United States. In that event, it seems to me that only in remote parts of the country would it be possible to save any lives at all, but that the major cities, the major target areas, the missile bases, the bomber bases would be attacked, and the population in that vicinity would certainly not be able to survive the blast, and it's doubtful that the people living in the fallout area could survive after having come out of the shelters, if they ever did.
May I explain my comment?
Pardon me, Mr. Cavers.
Sorry.
I would just like to supplement what has been said by adding another dimension of qualification. Customarily, it seems to me, people speculate as to the length of time they must remain in shelters, and they think of it in terms of 10 days or 2 weeks after the atomic attack. The concept of an atomic war that appears to be generally accepted is that we fire our rockets and they fire their rockets. The war is over. We wait in the shelters till the fallout clears up. We have no basis for assurance that that would be the pattern of an atomic war. Very possibly, we would find it extending out over a considerably longer period of time, and we are now up against the possibility that a single well-placed bomb can contaminate a state. The period in which people would have to remain in shelters would depend not on the interchange of the initial attack, but on how many subsequent bombings there were.
May I introduce this question at this point as to why, Mr. Riebhausen, if you feel that civil defense is so efficacious, there seems to be so much evidence that the Europeans don't care about it, and perhaps the Russians don't care about it?
I think the evidence is questionable, Mr. Goldman.
I think it is questionable.
I think the Europeans, particularly the Swedes, have been well ahead of us, both in fallout and blast protection. Now, they have blast protection, which would automatically give them fallout protection.
Well, you see what's in front of me, the New York Times, Europeans called to civil defense.
That's a headline.
Yeah. Well, then it goes on and outlines the thing, yeah.
The ability to protect against radiation, as Mr. Higginbotham will agree, I'm sure, is one that we know how to cope with. We do protect against great levels of radiation in the laboratory. So theoretically, it is possible to protect against radiation 100% unless there's an accident. Now, the problem that comes into this is whether we can anticipate and have a sufficient degree of protection to meet the maximum possible levels of radiation, and at what cost. In other words, what price you're going to pay for the insurance protection. Now, in the latest congressional hearings on the subject, it was accepted that the normal radiation that could be anticipated from an all-out attack would be 3,000 rentgens per hour at 1 hour after blast from fallout. Now, this doesn't mean that there might not be some hot areas that would be hotter than that. it doesn't mean also that there aren't large areas that will have far less than that. So if you can protect against 3,000 Rentkens per hour, you're buying a pretty good insurance policy. And when I say 100%, I mean theoretically we know how to do it, and if we want to pay for it, we can get practical protection.
Well, this is precisely what I mean when I say that it's possible for people to talk across purposes accepting the same basic facts. For example, Mr. Rebhausen has been referring to what happens when you're in a shelter while you have this Rentgen storm overhead with the massive doses of radiation. On the other hand, what Governor Minor was talking about was the fact that sooner or later you're going to have to come out of the shelters. And as Mr. Cavers has said, you've got the problem of a great deal of residual radiation depending on the severity of the attack and also the frequency of attack. So when the American people are told that shelters are 97% safe, they should be told what the circumstances are of such safety. What I object to is the statement that I saw yesterday carried by the Associated Press over the name of Dr. Libby, that there would be a 97% chance, but he didn't say under what circumstances there would be a 97% chance. I can conceive of circumstances under which there would be a 97% hazard. So it is important, it seems to me, to present the American people with the facts. I object to the American
Cousins,
people being kidded.
May I take off from where you
yes.
are? Like a lot of people, I've been puzzled by this issue of life, which I think you are quoting from, how you can survive fallout. 97 out of 100 people can be saved, it says. And then you look inside, and these fallout shelters are the most cozy, clubby, pleasant little things. Here's one, the girl's talking to her date. Here's another one back in here where the family's all gathered in pleasant surroundings. I, too, am puzzled by this kind of thing. In a responsible magazine, which incidentally bears a letter from the President of the United States endorsing it.
And well, in fairness to President Kennedy, did he endorse
yes.
this specific article with these specific
oh,
photographs?
He calls attention to this issue, yes.
Well,
I don't, apparently,
a message. I doubt that the President has accepted the facts or the alleged facts as stated in that article.
Pardon me. Here's the letter. I urge you to read and consider seriously the contents of this issue of life.
I do not believe that responsible people in the administration, Mr. Goldman, believe for a minute that we can protect 97% of the population through fallout shelters.
What do they believe?
Under any conceivable set of circumstances. I think that this whole question is one which calls for a real re-examination. I think that the American people have not been told, for instance, that a 100 megaton bomb would create a firestorm covering an area the size of the state of Vermont, or that a 50 megaton bomb dropped upon the city of New York would have effects and devastating effects, creating great death within a 5-mile radius and extending way out into the suburbs in terms of firestorms. I think the American people have not been told how long it would take to reach shelters, if they would ever reach them.
Well, why? Why
and
not
I think
tell
that
us?
I think that all of these questions should be thoroughly explored by the Congress of the United States. I have introduced a resolution asking that the principal committees of Congress go into these questions. Questions of the political effects, the economic effects, the social effects, the psychological
effects. Do you
expect
the administration to back your resolution?
I think that the administration is really examining this whole question right now. It's my belief that there are many unanswered questions and that the people in the administration are questioning seriously what the effect upon our defense policy, upon our foreign policy, and upon our own population will be of an all-out shelter program. It seems to me that we ought to examine this question from the point of view of how it will affect our relations with the rest of the world. It seems to me that too little emphasis has really been placed upon the need, continuing need, to search for peace, the continuing need to reach agreement upon arms control, because the only real insurance that we can have, the only real opportunity to survive in this world, is to bring the arms race under control. And if our people believe that we can survive an atomic war, then it makes it that much more difficult. I think the great danger is in making people believe, making people be resigned to the possibility of a nuclear war, which I do not believe any nation can survive and have civilization as we have known it.
By a happy coincidence, that moves us from our first point of the shelters as sheer protective devices, which I suspect we have not entirely settled, to the second one of the political implications, political in a larger sense. Mr. Ryan was commenting. Mr. Cavers, I know you feel strongly about this, too.
I do. I think that the way we can save the most lives is by not having a nuclear war. Hence, I think we have to evaluate a shelter program in terms of whether it makes a nuclear war more or less likely. I think there are various reasons for suspecting that it would make a nuclear war more likely. For one thing, it would represent a major step up in the arms race. I know we don't think of our own shelters as being involved in the arms race. They're merely defensive as we see them. As we see our opponent's shelters, however, we see them as providing a base from which they could safely launch an attack. As they see our shelters, very probably they would take the same view of them. But I think perhaps more serious than the interruption of the acceleration of the arms race would be the impact on people's attitudes. I'm less concerned, perhaps, than Congressman Ryan with the sense of security that people would have by virtue of shelters. I think, on the contrary, they would tend to be increasingly insecure as they came to know more about the limitations of the shelters and the buildup of weaponry that would be going on as they were improving their shelters. But what you would have would be mass anxiety moving to mass fear, to mass hatred of the source of the fear, to mass hostility, and that isn't the state of public mind in which you hope to negotiate arms control agreements, any political settlements. It's exactly the kind of mental environment in which wars are bred.
On that point, I was very much concerned about a pamphlet which has been issued in Nutley, New Jersey, by the civil defense people there, which says, and I just quote part of it, "A showdown must eventually come, or freedom shall be no man's privilege." It's practically a call to arms, and I think it relates very much to the point that Mr. Cavers has made, that civil defense will be used by those people who want to accelerate the arms race and will have that effect.
I think that you can't make a... one should not make a sweeping statement about people's attitudes. There are certainly people I know who are ardent advocates of shelters and of civil defense programs who are also working very, very hard on to try to achieve measures of disarmament. There are also people who feel that disarmament is entirely hopeless who are advocating shelter programs. So one can't make that statement. I would like to come back to Mr. Caver's point about the effect that this would have on the people and express a slightly different point of view. In the first place, I have a great confidence in the ability of people to think for themselves, and I think that we don't want to keep them from building shelters because this may cause them to think. I think it's very important, and we're having this program today to cause people to think because it's the most important problem to be studied. But it seems to me that I've been, as a scientist, called on sometimes to advise the government on defensive measurements, active defensive measurements, and on military policies. And I have felt that a large part of our public feels that they can buy security by encouraging the development of more and greater armaments, and that they really have very little idea of what kind of a world they're creating. Now we're beginning to find out. And it seems to me it might even be a good thing for people to have to build shelters or to at least discuss shelters very thoroughly and think hard about them so that they realize what kind of a world we have and how important it is to try to reach a peaceful settlement and avoid this war.
I agree thoroughly that we should work for peace. I do not agree, though, that a shelter program would diminish our ability or in any way impair our efforts for peace. It is not an either-or proposition. We can work for peace, and we can work for our own security. And I think we must consider the alternatives. These may not be alternatives of our making, but liberty is at stake. At the present time, the American population is almost totally vulnerable if an enemy wishes to attack the population. With a population that's vulnerable, We cannot expect the people to have the will to support the cause of liberty, either at home or abroad. We cannot expect the president to have the strength in his negotiations at the conference tables around the world that he would have if he had a confident people that was not wholly unprotected and vulnerable. So it seems to me these are the central issues.
I agree with Mr. Rebozen that the American people now are totally vulnerable. The question is, to what extent will the American people be made less vulnerable through a program of fallout shelters? The first problem you've got to contend with, it seems to me, is the problem of warning time. We all assume that somehow people will get into the shelters. Well, now, the enemy will not wait until the entire family is together. Let's say at 8 o'clock in the evening or 2 a.m. in the morning. If the enemy hits, he will hit at a time of maximum confusion. When daddy is in the city, mother is out shopping, the children are at various schools, and here you have the home fallout shelter, much more than the 15 to 20 minutes warning time we may have. The question of warning time is critical, and I repeat that when the statement is made that 97% of the American people can be safe, it forgets the prime fact that the warning time factor is the critical one.
May I come in
yes.
on that? I think this is a problem, as you have said several times, of what are we talking about. We can only talk about percentages and get agreement if we know the particular hazard we're talking about. I think the hazard of fallout, we know how to get virtually complete or 100% protection if we wish to pay for it. The total hazard, which is what you have properly come to several times, is one as of today, we have a very microscopic percentage of protection. But we, Dr. Teller has said, if we do the things we know how to do and that we can afford to do, we can get 90% protection. So that we have to have a program, and here's where I support Congressman Ryan. This will take a massive effort at the federal, the state, and the local level so that we move in on the problem of warning, on the shelter protection during the course of an attack, on the decontamination, on the recovery, on the stockpiling of food, and on the medicines, and then on the restoration of power, communication, community facilities, all of that that will make our society worth living, and it would be worth
yes,
living.
Yes, well,
we're organized.
I'm glad we all agree that it's important to support Congressman Fitzryan's bill, which has the purpose of discovering what the facts are. I just think that it's too bad that we didn't have these facts before we urged the American people to go ahead.
Mr.
And
Cavers,
I don't agree with
pardon me, Mr. Cavers has been wanting to come in here. Yeah.
My point was simply to call attention to the fact that whereas we are vulnerable at the present time, so are our opponents. Issues are arising as to how much shelter they have, how much we have, and it's obvious that neither of us have very much. I think this is one of the major protections we have against the hazard of nuclear war. Whether we, by accelerating the arms race, by arming ourselves with shelters, are going to make for greater peace or simply stimulate our opponents either to do that or to develop more terrible weapons is, I think, the question we have to consider. I think we have perhaps greater security in our vulnerability than we would if we have a jittery effort to build up massive shelter programs and to get ourselves in a state not of peace-loving qualities, peace-seeking qualities, but of downright fear and hatred, which I think is the more likely product than...
The gentleman, let me push this political point in its largest sense and put it in its bluntest form. What goes on around the lunch table, for example, in my faculty room, is a discussion as to whether there is now developing a basic political issue in the U.S. revolving around fallout shelters. The issue being this, is the administration attempting to use the fallout shelters, the reserve call-up, etc., a whole series of things, to create what might be called a tough public opinion? That is, a public opinion which is against concessions to the Russians, which will sustain the sending of troops to Laos, the whole concatenation of tough things. In this discussion, there usually comes an attempt to make a correlation in America as to whether those people who are very much behind the shelter effort are not also the people who want to be tough with the Russians and vice versa. And when that's done, you can always find some interesting evidence. Here is the man who's now really in charge of the fallout effort, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Mr. Pittman, who is putting the argument for fallout shelters not so much on the protection base, which you were putting it on, but as a way of determining our, as a way of demonstrating our will to face up to thermonuclear warfare. You see, it's a political argument. And here's Frank Ellis, the actual director of the Civil Defense Mobilization Unit, calling for a revival for survival, and say this will demonstrate that we have a national will. N-B-W. I think it'd be important to comment on that kind of thing.
Well, I think, Mr. Goldman, you've stressed one of the very important questions in this whole issue, and that is the extent to which civil defense may be used not merely to protect or to save lives, but as part and parcel of an aggressive foreign policy. And I think that we are deceiving the American people, and here's where I agree with Governor Minor. If we leave them to believe that we can wage nuclear war, I do not believe that the American people will be protected 97% or probably at all, because we haven't considered what happens afterwards. We haven't considered the problem of firestorms. We haven't considered the disruption of communications that will take place in a massive nuclear attack, the disruption of transportation facilities. I believe that we must aggressively wage peace. I believe that we should not consider, and this is where I disagree with some Defense Department authorities, we should not consider civil defense as part of our military posture, as you have pointed out to many authorities.
I think it's inseparable.
It's inseparable as a defense, but not as part of our deterrence.
It is part of our deterrence. I certainly regret using this as a threatening weapon. I think that to speak softly and carry a big shelter is not a very good policy. But so that I certainly feel that it's unfortunate that the program has been brought up in that way. But we do live in a world in which, in spite of all our efforts and the best of intentions and most thoughtful pursuit of policy, that nonetheless a war of some sort may break out. I don't want to divert it from this because I'd like to hear the rest of the criticisms.
I want to bring everybody in on this point, but I must interrupt for a moment to reintroduce you to guests who have tuned in late. Here to my right, Mr. Oscar M. Riebhausen, Chairman of Governor Rockefeller's Special Task Force on Protection from Fallout. Congressman William Fitz Ryan from the 20th District of New York City. Mr. David Cavers, Professor of Law at Harvard University. Mr. Norman Cousins of the Saturday Review, and Mr. William Higginbotham of the Brookhaven Laboratories. Now, Mr. Riebhausen, to get us back into this, I take it that you have a political argument attached to your own thought about this. Let me read this sentence to you. It should be emphasized, however, the purpose of fallout protection is not alone the vital one of assuring survival to tens of millions, but equally important, the actual deterrence of
absolutely
a nuclear war.
Absolutely. So it has a two-headed advantage. One, we can enable millions of Americans to survive if we have fallout protection. Secondly, with fallout protection, I am absolutely confident that we will be in a stronger position, not only to negotiate, but to deter three things. And the three things are, one, nuclear blackmail. When any potential enemy starts brandishing 100 megaton weapons over our head, we will not be as timid if we know that we can survive a measurable attack. Secondly, and the most important aspect of deterrence, if any potential enemy chooses to destroy liberties on the periphery of the communist world by moving into Berlin, by moving into Iran, by moving down into India, or anywhere else you name, we do not today have the capacity to wage a major war to stop that aggression if we're relying on conventional weapons. We must have a limited warfare capacity. But the last analysis, the thing that deters that kind of peripheral aggression, is the nuclear weapon, which has maintained the peace for more than 15 years since we've had it. So that the Russians, if they are contemplating an act of aggression, will be more likely to make that act of aggression. If the American people are exposed, open, and vulnerable, they would be less likely if they thought that we were not open,
Mr. Cousins.
You know, in the past few months, I've sat around a table like this with people like the gentleman here who have strong opinions on the question of shelters and the problem of national security and also the question of freedom. And recently, in discussing this question with some of them, these were advocates of shelters. When you really got down to it, you see, they agreed that you couldn't have the advertised protection in shelters. They agreed that the American people, once they learned what a firestorm was like and the problem of oxygen exhaustion, the problem of ventilation, also the problem represented by the fact that you're not building shelters for your livestock or shelters for your vegetables or grain and you can't live without them. They agreed about all this, but then they said, it's important for the American people or for the American nation to make credible to the Soviet Union the fact that we are ready to fight a nuclear war. And so I say, well, if this is your purpose in getting the American people to build shelters, why don't you say so? And they said, well, of course, if we did that, the American people probably wouldn't build the shelters. What I object to is the attempt to manipulate public opinion in the United States, to use the American people as pawns, and also to get a lot of fast buck operators who are trying to make money out of shelters to prey on poor people, and a lot of poor people who ought to be using this money for food and education are now putting this into shelters. I'll predict one thing. I just wanted to complete my thought, which is that we spoke a little while ago about political implications of this. I would like to speak about the political implications of it in a very direct sense. I believe that there is coming a wave of political revulsion in this country against this deception, and that anyone who is trying to make the American people feel that they have adequate protection without telling them what all the facts are, that anyone who is responsible for that will suffer politically as people have never suffered politically before.
There are a lot of things wrapped up in that statement. There is a 2-year food supply in this country, which, if prepositioned and properly stocked or processed, could enable our population to survive. There should be no problem of water.
How do you get to the food, sir?
This has to be planned in advance.
And how do you get to the water, sir?
This has to be planned in advance. And I should say, and as Congressman Ryan was saying, that there was no one working on this. The state of New York is working on this.
Well, don't you think these ought to be determined before the American people are urged to go ahead and spend their money on
this? This has to go along simultaneously.
Mr. Cavers has been remarkably patient.
My concern has been with Mr. Riefhausen's view that the American foreign policy may be tough because if we have a shelter program, then we know we can survive a nuclear war. Now, who is it that is going to do the surviving? Mr. Riefhausen, and this program is devoted to a fallout shelter program. That means that we're prepared to write off New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Washington, Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Houston.
You're presuming a plan of attack, Mr. Cavers, which is not necessarily the plan of attack that would be
used. I would agree that it isn't necessarily the attack. Perhaps
our
antagonists would be prepared to fight a limited war against us, but it certainly is a possible, and I would say a probable, form of attack. And given the kind of attack that I take it we are prepared to launch, then I would suppose it is even more likely. Now, if we are ready to write off those communities, not mention certain others, are we really going to put all our hearts into this strong foreign policy and put up these communities as pawns in our game of tough foreign policy? I think not. I think one thing certainly is going to happen. If we're going to push policies of this sort, the fallout shelter will soon become an obsolete concept, or rather a concept for the rural areas and exurbia. We will be concerned with blast shelters, with trying to burrow under our cities with billions of dollars of expenditure, with a program that would take us, I would say, 3 or 4 times as long to complete as it would take us to rearm ourselves with conventional weapons, if that is our need to defeat the Soviet threat. And I would say, as between the two, we would seem much less menacing with stronger conventional armaments than we would with a big blast shelter program.
It seemed to me that the people who are writing off the American population and the American cities are the people who say it's hopeless, let's do nothing. You must start somewhere, and you therefore must start with adequate warning, with good fallout shelter, move in on blast protection, take care of the post-recovery problems, the decontamination. All of this is manageable. I don't say that it's easy, but it is manageable. And we owe it to the American people to do something about it and not just be defeatist and say it's hopeless and surrender.
On the contrary, I don't think...
Mr. Well,
I just do not understand how Mr. Riebhausen may assume that the American cities, the major metropolitan areas, are not going to be subjected to severe nuclear attack. And I think that in our planning, we cannot exclude that possibility. And as soon as we assume that the cities may be hit, I do not see how we're going to continue as the nation we have been. Because unless you really dig in and really have blast shelters throughout the country, unless we are prepared to put the United States and all of its cities and principal facilities underground in order to be prepared to wage war, then I do not see how it can be effective. And I think, again, we are deceiving ourselves if we believe that the shelter program can be effective in any area except the rural parts of the country, and then I question how effective it can be.
Well, you've asked a very good question, and I think I can give you an answer in several ways. First place, if any potential enemy has only 60 intercontinental ballistic missiles, where is he likely to use them? He's probably likely to use them against our truly enormous retaliatory power. That will not leave him any missiles left over.
If he has only 60 missiles.
If he has only 60.
If he has only 60, isn't he going to keep out of nuclear war? In other words, aren't we really up against this problem only when, as and if, we are confronted by an enemy which is armed much more strongly than that? Now, I hope you're right in thinking that our adversary has no more than 60 nuclear weapons, but if that's the case, then I don't think we are under the pressure to build the shelters.
He may avoid a first strike.
I didn't hear that, Mr. Higginbotham.
So you have 1,000 airplanes to contend with, too.
If we avoid a first strike, too, then aren't we going to be...
Everyone, again, tends to think of this in terms of a surprise attack against the city in which they live. And starting from that egocentric basis, it's very difficult to see if you're directly under the point of the bomb how you'll survive. This was true of the infantryman who ducked into his foxhole. He knew if the artillery shell went in, he was through. But if he had a foxhole, it could land outside and he would be saved.
Since there seems to be a kind of a general gang up here on Mr. Riebhausen, may I step in for a moment your side and ask, for example, Mr. Cousins, what do you say to the man, the family head, who says, I've got a wife and two children. All right, maybe it won't protect me perfectly. All right, maybe some people are using it for political ends and so forth. But why shouldn't I build one anyhow? And why shouldn't I urge the governor to build one and the president to build one? It may do some good. What is your answer to him?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because this has happened many times, Mr. Goldman.
Yeah.
We have discussed this among our neighbors. I think it would be irresponsible of me to say to any man, do not build your shelter. But I think it would be grossly irresponsible of me if I were to say to a man, assume that everything is going to be all right, assume that these articles that you read, which say that you have a 97% chance of survival, are correct. I could not say that. What I can say is this, inform yourself fully. Know what a nuclear war is like. Know what the full range of a nuclear war is like. Know what the problem of ventilation is going to be in your shelter. Know what the problem of humidity is going to be. Know what the problem of an empty world when you come out of the shelter is likely to be.
But let's push it a step further. See, are you telling him not to build it or to build it? You see, because all these things he could do, and then he could say,
I'll tell you
what
I do tell him to do is this. I will say that the concept of the home shelter is, to my mind, an immoral and obscene concept. If this is important, I believe the government of the United States should do it. I don't believe that in the question of national survival, the government should say, well, you might be able to build this one for $87, you use this for $150, you may be able to have a television set in yours. I think this is much too serious to leave to this random basis. And this is why I approve Congressman Ryan's proposal, which is, let's find out what the facts are. Let's find out what kind of protection we can get, what it's going to cost, and then we can ask ourselves, what are the alternatives?
Now, Mr. Reba, speaking personally, you stand behind the individual shelter as well as the statewide and nationwide.
Yes, and I think I don't think there's agreement in the extremity of the disagreement in the extremity of language. But if a fellow has to learn to swim to stay afloat, you don't argue whether he learns the breaststroke or the crawl or just the dog paddle. So here, the important thing is that there be full-out protection readily available to every American citizen. Now, normally this will mean the home. Certainly the great rural areas of the country, this will mean the home. It would probably mean the home in the cities, where full-out protection is more readily obtainable because of the mass of concrete and steel that there is. But this does not preclude the desirability of having group shelters with our schools, accessible to our factories, accessible to our office buildings. So it's a mix of shelters.
Well, it does preclude them, does it not, if you accept, for example, the point of Mr. Cavers, that the mere building of them is going to have an effect on American attitudes and American foreign policy, which is unfortunate.
Well, it will have an effect on the attitudes and will of the American people. It will strengthen them and give them confidence.
Now, you say
it
strengthen.
It will not make them reckless.
Mr. Cavers?
He argues it will make them reckless.
Yes.
My view with respect to the individual who was concerned whether he wants to build a family shelter for himself and his family would be much the same as Mr. Cousins. To give him such facts as I would have at my disposal, I would let him make his own moral judgments. I think the problem of the adoption of a national policy to foster, to expand the development of home shelters will lead very rapidly to a demand, and a very reasonable demand, for a national policy to build shelters. If that policy is directed initially to fallout shelters, it will soon be extended to blast shelters, and we will find the nation burrowing underground. I think there are dangers to the nation in this undertaking which go beyond which involve other factors than international affairs. I think we'll become a different nation. I think, indeed, we may be in the process of contemplating the construction of a Frankenstein.
Some of these things are already happening, Mr. Cavers. For example, we now know that it is permissible to kill your neighbors under certain circumstances. Children are being psychologically preconditioned to accepting the fact of the murder of their playmates. And you're having around the country
this wouldn't exist if everybody had full-out shelters. This is a very temporary moral issue, and that no one could disagree with.
Could we hold that moral issue for just a moment? I think Mr. Higginbotham wanted to comment on the previous point.
Well,
do you want to go over into this moral one?
I would like to get in ahead of that, if I may, because I would like very much to endorse Congressman Ryan's proposal for a study. And I want to say distinctly why I believe this is important. I think that Mr. Cousins has mentioned it, but I would like to say it again. I think there is a considerable amount of information available on fallout. There are reasonable estimates can be made of various sizes of wars and what sort of damage would come from this. There's a fair amount of information on shelters per se, but not nearly enough. I think there's no way of telling at the present time whether it's more sensible from just if you agreed to build shelters, whether it make more sense to build them as individual or group shelters. And I think it's ridiculous for people to go out and build individual shelters until that decision has been made. And I feel that this whole thing is something which is very much tied up with the whole political and strategic picture of the United States, whether the degree of our civil defense preparations, I think, affects and has a very important impact on things international as well as internal. I think that in addition to the shelter itself, there is a great deal more information needed about food. In reading the hearings recently, I find that there's practically no knowledge of what's going to happen to plants and animals above ground. These things need to be studied very much. We need to study more about the economics and various other aspects. To tell a person that it's useful or to imply that it's useful for an individual to build a shelter when you have not made preparations for food or for the recovery period after is sort of nonsense. I would also say that for a state, a single state in the United States, to have an extensive shelter program is something like that state signing a separate peace treaty with Russia. It doesn't make sense except on a whole national basis after a lot more study.
Gentlemen, we have only about 12 minutes left, and let's now move directly into this moral and psychological issue. Some of this material that I have is incredible in that area. We seem to have lifted a sore top on this. Here's a man in Maryland writing about, let's go ahead with shelters. From a purely Darwinian point of view, this will not be calamitous at all. If a million or so of our sloppier citizens disappear as a result of their own lack of ability, that will be fine. Here's Bakers, California, arming against the people from Los Angeles. Here's the director of the Rockland County, Mr. Rubhausen, New York State Division, saying nobody's telling anybody else whether they're building one. Secrecy coming in. Here's Mr. Eisenhower's famous comment. You all know that one. If I were someplace else and my family were in and I, or reverse, I just would walk out into the neutrons. I wouldn't want to live in that kind of a world. I like Jules Pfeiffer's best of all. He says, in suburban civil defense, our motto now is, if you can't get yourself a Russian, settle for an American.
Mr. Goldman, you quoted General Eisenhower, and in the context in which you quoted him, or at least in the company in which you quoted him, it was made to appear that that quotation was perhaps somewhat farcical. But I think
I thought he was raising a moral issue.
He was, but in the context of the country. You see, but the point that he made, it seems to me, is absolutely sound, which is this. There is no force on earth that could keep a mother from running out of a shelter to her children if they were at a distance, which is what would happen if the burst occurred during the daytime. Now, the significant thing, it seems to me, is that we have not yet discussed an alternative. I believe there is a real shelter for this world and for the United States and for freedom. I am as deeply interested in freedom as is Mr. Rebhausen. But I believe that the best shelter we can get today is peace. And I would like to see the United States of America invest just as much imagination, energy, and money into the attempt to get peace while we're still alive. This may be, in fact, the best chance we have. And I don't think we're doing as good a job on that level as we possibly can.
By all means, do the very best job that we can. But may I add one qualification? We want peace, but we want peace with justice.
No question about that.
Absolutely.
I don't think there's any contradiction, sir, between peace and freedom. As a matter of fact, I don't think that peace is meaningful without freedom. But in today's world, I don't think you can get freedom without peace. Because
Mr. Ryan, are you in favor of peace, too?
I think that Mr. Cousins has raised the key issue which underlies the whole problem. I would like to come back for a minute to your comments on the moral issue. Certainly, we have seen in the past few months with the really incredible statements that have been made by many people that this does raise a very serious moral problem. And it raises questions as to how the civil defense program, if it was a massive program, would be administered. Who is to determine who comes into a shelter, who stays out of a shelter? What is to be done about developing leadership to handle the shelter program? Does this mean that we're going to have to impose upon the American people a very tightly controlled discipline? Does this mean that we're going to have to almost have a garrison state in order to carry out effectively a shelter program? Are we going to rout people out of bed, as has been suggested, at 2 o'clock in the morning or at midnight in the middle of the winter and drill them? What about drills in schools? All of this is going to have vast implications upon our whole fabric in America. And I think that we should look deeply into these questions, and I think we should come back again to the question of what is the real way to achieve peace and to achieve effective disarmament.
Yeah, well, now, assuming all that and assuming that we should look into it, pardon me, Mr. Cavers.
I would like to add one other factor that we have to take into account if we think of pursuing shelter and peace at the same time. The development of a full-scale blast shelter program has been estimated to cost in the neighborhood of $20 billion. I think that's a gross...
Fallout shelter.
Just fallout?
Fallout
yes.
Shelter.
That's the highest
that's
estimate
the highest.
By the
just for fallout.
Navy Radiological Laboratory.
I would say that any estimate of this character is almost inevitably a gross underestimate. As you concentrate activity in a particular area of the economy, This will generate its own inflations. The acquisition of land for shelter in some parts of the country, including the one from which I come, will have a very inflationary effect on the price of land. I can see a whole industry developing which will be making a great drain on the taxpayer. Now, while we're doing that, are we going to spend what we need for schools, for education generally, for public health, and for overseas programs? I think the contrary is true. We'll find ourselves putting more and more into shelter, more and more into weapons, less and less into the peaceful
objectives.
I certainly agree with Mr. Cousins' statement that the most urgent problem matter for this country to pursue is disarmament. But this is not something which we know how to achieve instantaneously. And it seems to me that pending the time that we can begin to reach agreements, which I hope is soon, and I would like very much to have time to discuss that further, that pending that time, that it is our policy to keep the country strong. And it seems to me that most of the arguments which have been made tonight against a shelter plan would apply with equal force against spending $20 billion on Polaris submarines, which also causes inflation in various areas and which certainly is an extremely expensive undertaking.
Are you bothered by these moral questions at all in this?
Very much.
Are they solved in your mind?
I like people, and I really couldn't conceive of shooting my neighbor, and I don't think he'd shoot me.
You don't think these moral questions, which disturb so many people, will come up on the
If you're program. Talking about a nuclear war, you're talking about a war. And a war is a terribly cruel, dirty thing. And this would be much worse than anything that's ever been experienced in the past. I certainly hope we don't have to do it.
You know, it may be, Mr. Goldman, that one of the most difficult facts for the human mind to accept is that we have reached a point in human history when you can protect a man against everything except people. There is no longer any defense. I think we ought to grow up and accept this fact. This time the human race is going to make it out in the open, or it is not going to make it at all. I am not giving up. I believe that the cause of freedom and the cause of man are inseparable, and that this country, if it wishes to maintain its freedom and wishes to maintain its values, has to recognize that it cannot achieve its purposes or its objectives through nuclear war.
I have received the signal. We have only 1 minute, and trying to hold this a little more strictly to the fallout shelters, I think, Mr. Riebhausen, you richly deserve a last word on this.
At least.
yes.
Well, it's an extremely complex subject, and I certainly agree that there has to be a careful survey of what can be done. The state of New York is doing that for the whole range of problems. And until people can be assured that these problems that they will face can be solved, they will have all these other fears and raise all these problems. And I thought that Mr. Higginbotham's comment was a very pertinent one. We raise in opposition to the fallout shelter program all the problems that would apply with greater validity to our $42 billion defense program.
I'm sorry, that last word must be cut off. I will be back in just a moment.
In this modern day and age, in this day of speed and space, here's a pleasant, easy way to help you stand today's fast pace. Look for the spear and get chewing enjoyment. Look for the spear, get Wrigley's. Fresh, strong, lively, long-lasting too. You say Wrigley's is great to chew. Look for the spear and get chewing enjoyment.
We're the biggest little treat in all the land.
Get the package with the spear and you'll know enjoyment's here. Be sure it's Wrigley's gum. After eating, after smoking, during work and during play, give your mouth a fresh, clean taste, this pleasant, easy way. Look for the spear and get chewing enjoyment.
We're the biggest little treat in all the land.
Get the package with the spear and you'll know enjoyment's here. Be sure it's Wrigley's gum.
For this vigorous and spirited program, may I thank you, Mr. Oscar M. Riebhausen, you, Congressman William Fitz Ryan, Professor David F. Cavers, Mr. Norman Cousins, and Mr. William Higginbotham. Thank you for being with us, ladies and gentlemen, and goodbye for this week.
WNBC-TV has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind was Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Mr. Oscar Riebhausen, Congressman William Fitz Ryan, Professor David Cavers, Mr. Norman Cousins, and Mr. William Higginbotham. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, WNBC-TV, New York 20, New York.